Bill Bryson would strike most of his readers to be an unlikely candidate to write about the home. He's often called a travel writer with books about England, Australia, Africa, the Appalachian Trail, and one even covered the entire universe. He's also written a biography of Shakespeare, several works on the English language, but his latest, At Home, A Short History of Private Life, records a voyage around his house, a Victorian parsonage in England. Of course, the history, biography, anthropology, and biology show that even such a limited journey through a home can become just as vast as a trip across the universe. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that Bill has left his home to visit our show once again. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Dominique Browning notes in a New York Times review that your short histories are anything but, this one is 450 pages long. A Short History of Nearly Everything was 550 pages long. In fact, the one that I would have thought would have been long, A Walk in the Woods, which refers to a walk of over 2,000 miles, was the shortest of those books.
Yeah, well, when I say short history, it's short in the sense that I'm dealing with very big subjects that could go on and on and on and on. So when you compare what is the book consists of compared with what might have gone in there, they are pretty concise.
In talking about this book, you've said houses aren't refuges. That's a word that I'm – okay. Anyway, they're not refuges from history. They are where history ends up. What do you mean by that?
Well, everything that happens –
why can't I pronounce the word?
Everything that happens in the world, whatever is discovered or fought over or invented – eventually, one way or another, it ends up in your house. I mean, a classic example would be all Christopher Columbus's voyage to the New World. And it gave us, who come from the European world, all kinds of foods that had never been known before. And, tomatoes, potatoes, corn, all of those things. But, brought all that back to Europe.
Chocolate, vanilla.
Yeah. But, imagine Italian cuisine without tomatoes. And that's all because of those discoveries. So, and it's like that. I mean, you can do the same, make the same analysis with, furnishings and art and fabrics and all kinds of things. So whatever happens in the wide world eventually translates in one way or another into the accoutrements of your own home.
The structure of these chapters remind me of personal essays. For example, the passage. The subject is ostensibly the servant's corridor, but then you wind up discussing the erection of the Eiffel Tower, Thomas Edison. To some degree, is this a trip through the corridors of your mind?
Well, kind of. I mean, the one thing I didn't want to do when I set off to write this book was I didn't want it to become just a sort of dull, predictable chronological history. So I never wanted to be writing sentences that said, and then came the Windsor chair, or that kind of thing. I wanted it to be discursive. The rooms, it is a journey through my house, an actual house. And the rooms, from my point of view, the rooms are not, they're just kind of launch pads. They give us boundaries, a kind of subject area. But if you start, if you have a room called the kitchen and you're going to talk about things germane to the kitchen, you can go in all kinds of directions. Well, and same with passage and bedroom and all the others.
Well, of course, if you were a New Yorker who's just starting out, you'd be in a studio apartment and this would be a short history. The theme of the book is technology spread from one application to another. Tell us, for example, how the stove led to taller buildings.
The stove. Oh, well, the development of the chimney.
Yeah,
it was. Yes. Well, originally houses were essentially a single room. When I say originally, started with the Anglo-Saxons, and when these Germanic tribes came into Britain, they brought with them a new kind of house, which was the hall house. It was a single room. Hall was their word for it. So hall is one of the oldest words in the English language. And it was in the middle of the room where there would be an open fire and just a kind of bonfire in the middle, blazing away in the middle of the room. And the smoke from that would rise up into the roof space and just accumulate there until it leaked out a hole in the roof, which meant that all of the space—
Probably a thatched roof, so it went through the weaving.
Yeah. So the upshot of this was that space up there was unusable because it was just full of choking smoke. I mean, you couldn't be up there in that smoke. So what was really needed was a chimney which would channel the smoke out of the house it would segregate it from the rest of the house. And once invented proper chimneys that could stand up to roaring fires, which needed invention of really good modern bricks. And that was in about the time of Geoffrey Chaucer. Then it became possible for houses to move upwards, and at the same time they moved outwards. But the particular change in cultural change was moving upwards, because it just by going upwards, by having another floor, a separate space, it begins to introduce the whole concept of privacy, which had never existed in houses before. Previously, everything had been done in the one room. I mean, all life had been lived communally in a single room. There was no privacy at all for anything. You ate and slept and procreated and did everything right there with everybody else around. But with the invention of an upstairs, suddenly these things could become private. It changed the whole way we changed relationships. It changed the way we live. It changed everything about human arrangements.
You open the book with a description of London's Crystal Palace. What does that have to do with our homes today?
Well, in a sense, very little, but in one sense, a lot. It was partly I did that because the Crystal Palace was built in 1851, which is the same year that our house in Norfolk, this old rectory, an old parsonage, was built. So it was the Crystal Palace helped to set the scene. I was just using that partly as a way of saying this is what was going on in the world at that time.
But this is early Victoria.
Victoria came to the throne in 1837, so she'd been there for a little over a decade. And the thing about the Crystal Palace also was that it was the first World's Fair, and it was the first. It was devoted very largely, though not exclusively, but very largely to consumer products. It was the first time that the Industrial Revolution, the consumer side of the Industrial Revolution, was put on display and became a kind of international pageant. And it was, you know, people could come and see all kinds of things, and well, I mean, flushing toilets for one thing. I mean, most people, that was their first experience of a real proper flushing toilet, and lots of consumer goods. I mean, there were like 50 different kinds of soap on display. People didn't have soap, and not soap that you purchased. You might have some kind of house-made, you know, homemade soap, so there was all kinds of consumer goods that were suddenly on display at the Great Exhibition.
So flushing toilets leads to the idea of having a separate room for the toilet,
exactly,
rather than the outhouse.
Yeah, yes. I mean, a flushing toilet was a dream, an aspiration that had gone back a long, long way. I mean, the very first flushing toilet actually dates from the time of Queen Elizabeth I. People had been trying to make flushing toilets. The problem with them wasn't flushing away the waste. The problem was keeping the odors from drifting back into the house. And it needed the invention of that curious little U-bend at the bottom. You know, the reason you have a reservoir of water in the bottom of your toilet after you flush it is, you know, it's not there for decorative purposes. It actually keeps the odors from creeping back into the house.
What about your house in England? Is the floor plan of this rectory similar to what a modern home would be, or is it more typical of what an early Victorian home was?
Well, the answer is yes and no to that. I mean, it is generally it is an interesting thing about houses that, you know, in 1851, this rector, 28-year-old rector who built the house, clergyman, built the house that was designed for people living in pre-industrial, pre-electric age, I mean.
Did they have specific tasks, specific rooms?
Yeah, they had dining rooms and kitchen for cooking, and a larder and pantry for keeping the you know, for washing the dishes and keeping provisions and things in. So it was a house that was very easily adapted to 21st century needs. And it's an interesting thing about houses. I mean, you know, that when you think about lifestyles, they've changed really utterly, and yet the houses, the spaces, have not so much. So that we can live very comfortably in houses that are hundreds of years old. Because, I mean, once you introduce plumbing and electricity and so on, they become just as serviceable. Certainly the case in England. I mean, a lot of people live in houses that are 200 or 300 years old.
I think your introduction to the hall, which is one of the my favorite chapters, because the hall has changed, shows the way that you deal with history. And could you just read a little bit
for us? I'd be delighted.
From page 44.
No room has fallen further in history than the hall. Now a place to wipe feet and hang hats, once it was the most important room in the house. Indeed, for a long time, it was the house. How it came to this curious pass is a story that goes back to the very beginnings of England and a time, 1600 years ago, when boatloads of people from mainland Europe came ashore and began, in an entirely mysterious way, to take over. We know remarkably little about who these people were, and the little we do know often makes no sense. But it was with them that the history of England and the modern house begins. As conventionally related, events were straightforward. In AD 410, their empire collapsing, the Romans withdrew from Britain in haste and confusion, and Germanic tribes, the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes of 1,000 schoolbooks swarmed in to take their place. It seems, however, that much of that may not be so. First, the invaders didn't necessarily swarm. By one estimate, perhaps as few as 10,000 outsiders moved into Britain in the century after the Romans left, an average of only 100 people a year. Most historians think that is much too small a figure, though none can put a more certain number in its place. Nor, come to that, can anyone say how many native Britons were there to receive or oppose the invaders. The number is variously put at between 1.5 million and 5 million, in itself a vivid demonstration of just how comprehensively vague a period we are dealing with here. But what seems nearly certain is that the invaders were very considerably outnumbered by those they conquered.
Bill Bryson reading from his latest book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life, published by Doubleday. Even now, the concept of the hall has changed. More and more houses are built without hallways. But I used to live in an apartment where the halls were so big that I used it for my dining room. I used one portion of it for my dining room.
Yeah, well, it's depending on, you know, when these things were built, and they can still, you know, the hall can still be quite a grand space. It's kind of a shame that it has been demoted so, because, you know, as I say, the hall once was the house, and that survives in a lot of terms in English. I mean, words like Carnegie Hall and Study Hall, Hall of Fame, halls of Montezuma, those all denote large, important spaces, and that's the reason they do, because once upon a time the hall was a very large, important space.
In some of these, the things you write about, you make the house sound like a rather frightening place, considering the fact that Halloween is coming up. I guess you could scare people with stories about stairs and wallpaper and bed springs.
Yeah, well, once upon a time, even your wallpaper could hurt you. The late 19th century, about two-thirds of all wallpaper, in England anyway, and presumably elsewhere, was made with copper arsenite, which is essentially arsenic. And a lot of people got very sick just from sleeping in bedrooms that were papered with poisonous wallpaper. Nobody really quite understood why they were getting ill. They did notice that rooms that had this kind of wallpaper seldom had bed bugs, but they didn't equate the thing that was killing the bed bugs to what was making people ill.
Well, considering the fact that bed bugs have made a serious comeback, maybe we need to decide what's worse, having arsenic in wallpaper or having bed bugs. When I read your books, regardless of the subjects, I always come away with a supply of knowledge of things I had always taken for granted, and this book is no exception. I'd like to do a quick run-through for a few things. We don't have a lot of time, okay. But for example, how did salt and pepper become the two spices on every dining room
table? That's not a question to ask when you don't have a lot of time, but essentially they are – once upon a time, spices were the most important thing in the world. I mean, they weren't just important foodstuffs. They were the most important commodities of any type. They were more precious than gold. And
isn't it why Columbus set out to...
Columbus was looking for spices. Magellan was looking for spices. All those great explorers were looking for spices because it would make them very, very rich. And there was a huge demand for them, not just as something to sprinkle on food, but just as a kind of commodity in themselves, much like, you know, you might have bars of gold.
But salt and pepper, not curry.
Salt and pepper are essentially relics of that. They are the kind of fossils of that. I mean, the spices were extremely expensive, and if you bought them, you displayed them ostentatiously on your dining table so that people could see and admire how wealthy you were. And salt and pepper are just kind of relics of that impulse.
And now you have to beg a waiter to bring some salt or pepper.
You do indeed, yes.
Or they come over with those huge devices and ask if you want some pepper. You have no idea until after you eat the food. Why do forks have four tines?
Well, forks originally had two tines because originally forks were not for eating. They were for just sort of spearing turkeys and gooses and geese, I'm sorry.
Well, we have those. We still have
those. Yeah, we still have those. So if you can imagine those scaled down and used as for eating, that's what the first forks were like. But people very quickly discovered that was not practical because with a two-pronged fork, it's very easy to stab yourself in the lip or tongue. And so they started introducing more tines, sometimes as many as eight. And it just happens that for some reason, psychological human reason, we just feel more comfortable with four.
What's the most German-fested area of the modern home?
The most German-fested area of the modern home? Wow, this is not the toilet, as you would expect, but the kitchen. And I think particularly the kitchen counter around the draining board is the area. There was a guy at the University of Arizona named Dr. Gerba who has spent a lifetime doing surveys of germ infestations around the house and found that the places we most expect germs tend not to be in highest concentrations because we clean those the most assiduously. And it's places like kitchen counters that only tend to get wiped down with a damp cloth that's probably quite infested with bacteria in the first place that are the worst.
Part of the fun of reading this book is that we find out all sorts of things that go beyond a person's discoveries. We learn about their quirks and eccentricities. For example, you talk about a celebrated germ expert from the University of Arizona who gave his daughter the middle name, and now I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, Escherichia?
I don't know how you say it either.
That's the E and E. coli. Now, that's not a name that I would give to my child.
No. The man is called Dr. Germ and seems – apparently, I've not met him, but he seems to welcome that title. He is one of the experts in the world on things like E. coli and other infestations. And the world is indubitably a better place for having him and having this interest in it. But it is one of his idiosyncrasies is, as you say, he gave his child –
And how do you find that out? Is it that's not in his Wikipedia listing?
No. That was from an article I came across an archive article from the New York Times. They did a profile of him a few years ago, and there have been other articles about him. And of course, something like that it is mentioned in every single time he's written about, including in my book. Nobody's going to let that one go by.
Well, we don't have time to get into some of the others, but we do learn how Baker's Dozen came about, why we use the term ground floor. How the word corn was invented, room and board, why board, a lot of stuff that Bill Bryson tells us in this short history of private life. He's called At Home, his latest book, which is published by Doubleday. And Mr. Bryson will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square. Does it feel weird coming back to the United States?
No, it feels like coming home. It really does, especially when baseball playoffs are on.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.